Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining me on the BIPOC Outside podcast. I'm Chris Cromwell, and today we're sitting down with Brittany Levitt. Brittany's a Jill of all trades in the climbing community, an educator, instructor, athlete, community organizer, and a founding member and the executive director of Brown Girls Climb. So let's get into it, shall we? Hey, friends. Before we get into it, I wanted to ask, have you found us on social media? That's where we share educational resources, outdoor scholarships, grants, and career opportunities, edit drops from athletes, and other Stoke-inspiring content. Find us at BIPOC Outside on X, Facebook, and Blue Sky, or BIPOC Outside Pod on IG and Threads. Brittany, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I am doing all right. You're at the end of February. I was going to say we're in the middle. No, we're at the end of February. So doing all right for the new year.
Awesome. So let's jump right into it. You grew up on the East Coast, spending time in upstate New York, in Maryland. So what introduced you to the outdoors?
Yeah, so I've been in the outdoors since I was a baby, in a sense. And then I say that as my parents were gardeners. So anytime that they were out in the garden as a kid, they would always have us outside, either if we were babies on blankets, just being in the open air. Then if you got older, getting too used to being in the dirt and playing in the mud. And for me, as a kid, the outdoors was as going into my backyard, going into my neighborhood park, or if we were going to visit family, we would drive all the way upstate to New York to my grandmother's farm. Or if you were going to go visit my dad's side of the family, we would go to the Boston area and hang out by the shoreline and the cabins. So being by the ocean. And for me, that kind of helped me expand like what I could possibly do in the outdoors. So since I was a kid, I knew I wanted to work in the outdoors. I knew I wanted to be a naturalist, but I didn't understand the expansion, like how big it could be to be working in the outdoors. And yeah, it's really cool for me to just say, oh yeah, I just started getting involved in the outdoors by my own backyard pretty much.
That's amazing. It starts at home. Mm-hmm. And you're still gardening. You're now involved in the gardening club.
Yeah, I live in New York City now. And so in New York City, there are green spaces, but there are not many green spaces. But often these green spaces are run by different organizations. And there are plenty of community gardens. And what's really cool, oftentimes we hear this term of community gardens as just a space to grow food, but it's so much more. It's a space for people to find that moment of connecting to nature, to building with each other as neighbors, to just having the space to feel tranquil, but then also to grow your own food. And so I'm part of a really cool collective called Cooper Street Community Garden, which is in Bushwick, New York. And what's unique about our garden, there are a lot of different levels of rules with gardens in the city too. Oftentimes you may have to rent out a plot, you have to pay for it. There might be like politics in the garden, which is weird to think about, but it is. And so what's beautiful about our space is it's intergenerational. It is a space where we have artists who are local Bushwick neighbors that come in, but all the garden boxes, no one owns them, no one rents them out. We all decide like what we're doing right now. We all decide what we're going to, what we want to grow in those spaces. So it's a lot of medicinal plants to fruits and vegetables, things that are easy to harvest, things are that are able, like when I say medicinal, chamomile and things that you would use for medicine and healing, to really easy things for our neighbors and ourselves to harvest tomatoes and cucumbers and basil and so much more. And then flowers, because we also tried to bring in pollinators and creating that natural understanding of the beauty of bees and butterflies. And it's just such a beautiful space. And I've gotten to be part of it for coming up 3 years now. And I just took on a big role of being the garden coordinator. So another role where I'm like helping oversee and organize our garden, which has been a really fun task because we do a lot of different art events, fundraisers and things like that. So our garden community right now, we're like buzzing in our like chat about like strategy of how we're going to fundraise, what things we want to grow. And a big overhaul that we're doing this year is we're actually doing a whole redesign of our garden. Our boxes are very old and we're starting to rot and pretty low to the ground. So not accessible as they could be. And so what we did is we're going to do a big overhaul of getting new boxes that are much higher so they're accessible for folks to be able to actually sit in gardens, especially because we have a lot of elders that come into our garden space. But then also creating more wider walkways for folks to like navigate through. We're going to actually have a children's area, which would be we've been wanting for a while, where it's going to be a sensory thin area where kids can, like, obviously kids can get in the other areas, but like having a space where we can have like workshops for them, story time, but then also for them just to be in dirt, which is so important. And then also we have composting, so I'm going to expand on a composting area. And then we actually are working with this other organization called SAW, which is an architect school. But it's really cool architect school because it works with students who build things for communities, but they do it in the most ethical way it's possible, which means that instead of coming into a space and being like, oh yeah, it looks like you need this, so we're going to build this for you. It's more so they go in, they survey not only the community, the area, what makes sense for them to build something here, why would this structure actually fulfill the community space. And it's really mindful, which is such a cool thing. And it obviously it's a class. And so they're teaching them how to be an ethical architect going on to when you're building out buildings. Because oftentimes in New York City, you get a building that's a new apartment building just built up and there's no ethical way of checking in neighbors. And it's been really cool. They're going to help build our new archway for our hanging vegetables and fruit. We'll have our hanging squash and cucumbers and our peas and things like that. And really stoked. This year is a big year of this new changes and new creative things in the garden space, which is so much fun. And I love talking about the garden because I literally tell everyone, come, just come on over if you need space. Because really, it's like people are yearning for just a touch of grass or a space to be in dirt. And so I always tell them just, yeah, come on over and come water for us or come hang out for volunteer hours. And people are like, oh yeah, can I do that? Do I need to sign up? I was like, nope, just come on over. I know people need just a little ounce of connection with nature. And this is like one part you can do, especially in New York City.
I love that. And as an educator in a university space, like collaborating with what will be the next generation of professionals building in the space, giving them hands-on learning and community is wonderful. The garden sounds incredible. And when we see you, oftentimes we're seeing you on like big, wild adventures. But you've also, you're living in New York, you've lived in DC, and this is such an important way to get outside in the city. What other ways do you get outside in the city?
Yeah, so other ways that I get outside in the city, I do a lot of walks. So where I live in Crown Heights, so I live close to a park called Prospect Park, which is like by the same person who created Central Park. I love Prospect Park a little bit more because it feels a little bit more out of the city. So I often do a lot of walks around there. I'll take the train to go all the way to the Rockaways, which is the beach area. So there, New York City does, it's close to the beach wise, and you can actually take the train right to the beach. Not only hanging out with friends on the beach, but learning how to surf with friends, to going to the beach at night to have beach bonfires. Though you feel like they're still in the city, but still having that experience, because that's something that I did growing up living in Maryland. I lived on the Eastern Shore for a little while, so we were close to Astatic Island and Ocean City. During the summertime, we would have bonfires on the beach all the time, and it's cool to be able to still do that with newer friends and still have that experience of just getting outside in nature. Noting that, like, you have the botanical gardens as well. There's a lot of like public bike trails that you can utilize, like mini parks where you can sit and have picnics. So there's ways to get connected into nature that are like in the city as well. And then also, as I will travel out, like going a little further north, upstate is where I go hiking and climbing. I do a little bit of climbing outside in the city as well, because there's a few bouldering areas that you can go to. And then there's also an area further north of Harlem area called Fort Tryon that is also a bouldering area. So a big thing is working with a couple really grand climbing organizations and gyms where we're trying to build a partnership with Central Park to like, A, we want to do like a crack cleanup, but then also do some lessons around as folks get stoked of getting outside, like how do you be so like safely and ethically and like also learning the environment. And then as folks kind of start from Central Park, they'll start expanding going north or going over out west. And so having folks feel prepared and confident to do so. So yeah, there's many different ways that you can find like connecting to nature. Bird watching is also another one. Walking in the park and looking at different plants, tree identification. Obviously, these aren't like big mountain lost in like Denali type of things, but they're still being connected in nature. And these are also things I often did when I was living in the DC, Maryland area as well, like going to like Anacostia Park, skating in Anacostia Park, hanging out by the river, going kayaking. And so finding different ways to still feel connected while also being in the city.
That's incredible. Your enthusiasm and your excitement thrills me as like an active transport advocate in my own city. I love your energy around this. Moving further afield from urban spaces and getting into some wild spaces, tell me about one of your favorite adventures.
Okay, there's so many I've gotten to experience. I feel like I'll start with one of the most recent favorite adventures. I got to go to Puerto Rico for the first time, where I got to go climbing and swim in the water and swim with coral reef, which was like such a mind-blowing thing. But also I love stand-up paddleboarding. So I got to stand-up paddleboard in the water. And then my friend, Trumi, who also runs like a really dope surf organization in the Rockaways called La Rabea. They're also surfers, sports, total awesome human being. They're like, oh, do you want to practice surfing on a stand-up paddleboard? Which they're much thicker than surfboards. And I was like, sure. And we went all the way out. I was catching waves. And what was super cool was that there were sea turtles swimming around. So each time as I was trying to get prepared to paddle out, I'd yell like a child. And I'm like, oh my God, there's a sea turtle and it's popping up right here. And to me, it's like, you have to paddle because in a sense of safety, like if I'm not going to hold up, like I have to keep going. And so I was, but it's just like a cool, magical moment of adventuring and like being connected with nature and seeing nature in its home and recognizing like the beauty that is there too. And I don't know, it's like one of those moments. I love being in the ocean. And so having that experience and also experience it with community was something that was just magical. And then I think hiking wise, I got to do a few years ago the Presidential Traverse, which is in the White Mountains. A lot of folks know about the Presidential Traverse if you hike the Appalachian Trail. It's just a big, long stretch of mountains, about like 10 mountains, obviously named after the presidents. My friend and I, we changed the name of them because we're like the Presidential Traverse. We called it Damn the Man. So that was our hiking trip. And we're like, yeah, we're not. No, but it was like this beautiful experience. I love the White Mountains and I love the experience of just being on the ridgeline and get to go up to Mount Washington, which is the highest point on the East Coast, over 6,000. But just being in that space of hiking, I enjoy it so much. And also being hiking with your best friend and adventure buddy makes all the difference. So whatever, we dealt with rain, we dealt with wind, we dealt with having to hike maybe 2 more miles inwards to go camp and then had to go backwards to get on trail. And it just creates a good memory, a story of an experience of like, why did we do this? And afterwards, I was like, oh yeah, we should do it again. And they're like, no. I'm like, but we could do it the opposite way type of thing. And so I just love backpacking. Like oftentimes now, most folks see me as a climber, but originally when I got into the space of guiding, I was backpacking and I just love doing it. And I've gotten to experience some really beautiful mountain experiences like climbing Mount Baker or Tahoma and Komakoshan or Mount Baker. Those were beautiful experiences. And then I think also thinking about mountaineering adventures is like being able to climb Kilimanjaro with the Outdoor Afro team, and that was a whole thing. And yeah, and just being able, I think climbing wise, the experiences I've gotten is just, I spent a week in Yosemite climbing and climbing with community, climbing in Waco Tanks, which is a beautiful area, and getting to explore more of Texas and Texas national parks and spaces, which is also really beautiful, to climbing down south. Yeah, going through, I'm like, wow, I haven't done a lot overseas in other countries, but a lot here in the States. And it reminds me, despite a lot of things, when I think about the environment and the landscape of our country, it's so beautiful and vast and different. And recognizing not everyone gets that experience of knowing we have deserts and also a rainforest and also the canopies and you can have that mountaineering experience of being in the cold. And yeah, it's just something really cool that I realized that it's part of my job that I get to do now.
Amazing. We're going to talk a little bit more about Yosemite in a bit, but first I want to talk about Brown Girls Climb. Mm-hmm. So you're one of the founding members, now the CEO. It started as an Instagram account and has absolutely exploded. So tell me about it.
Yeah, so 2016, it started as like an IG account that my dear friend Betty Lovelitz started. In a way, like at the time was working in DC and was climbing and recognizing wanting to find other women climbers, but then also wanting to create a space of just storytelling and recognizing that we not only just thinking how like we see climbing, but climbing in general has been such a connected activity or sport in so many countries and communities around the world that we don't see it in that way. And so really, how do we tell the story of like how folks utilize it in that way? But then also, how do we tell the story of climbing isn't new within our community? We've been doing this for a really long time. It's just like our stories aren't making the climbing magazine, Outside magazine, until now, which is like really great. But back then, it was very few spotty of knowing, oh, are there other like Black climbers and things like that? And that came about, and we actually met on a panel for Black History Month, and we were DMing at the time. She was DMing a bunch of folks who were in the outdoor space as leaders, as guides, as just mentors about trying to create a space. Since we were in DC, we met. She already knew that at the time I was working with REI as a guide, rock climbing, backpacking, and I was also working with Outdoor Afro, and I was working at the Smithsonian as an early educator. So she knew that I was a programmer and doing that. And so we're like, what if we did a meetup and see how it went? So we did our first meetup at this area called Northwest Branch in Silver Spring, Maryland. It was just me, her, and one other person. Also, at the time, I was not a boulderer. I was more ropes. So I was like, cool, I'm down for this. And we had a blast, and then we realized like this could be something that we do more. So you can build out the whole founding team where there's other folks around the country who wanted something like this, but how do we build it? So then like Monse, Montserrat, and Seisha and Chella from Colorado became a cohort and started hosting events and meetups in that space. And then Laura from Massachusetts, and then Jael, California, and then we added Grace and Gabby. And so we built out a collective of folks who had a voice already in the outdoor space in some capacity, but then wanted to really see themselves, not only see themselves, but also wanted to create space for community. And recognizing too, when we first started, what we're seeing now is like the coolest thing ever, because when we all started, we were like, for me, I was a guide and I did not know many Black women who were rock climbing guides or backpacking guides. There are very few or some. And if we did, we are across the country. IG and like the ways that social media, how we can see ourselves now, wasn't a thing back then. It was still very like photos and not like being able to build a community. And so over the last, what's coming up this year would be 8 years, but the last 7 years, seeing how we've been able to cultivate those spaces by having meetups and gyms and building relationships and like really advocating of like, how do we expand on storytelling, but then also amplifying new voices who want to become leaders or guides or athletes in the climbing space. And so that for us meant like we were advocating and talking with like brands of, hey, this person is super strong, you should be adding them to your athlete team, or hey, this is something recognizing that's really harmful for a community, let's talk about it. And then also recognizing too, with our own organization, the different levels of hierarchy, the different levels of colorism that navigates within our own communities. How do we take ourselves accountable for ourselves and others? And so really having that space of, there's so many different lines of making sure that we're doing this community work, but then also making sure that we're holding ourselves accountable while we're doing this work. So there's multiple layers of that. And as I mentioned, we've been able to do so in multiple opportunities, from climbing meetups to being able to build out workshops. Monse and Betty and Shelmo, who was running Black Foxy, was able to build out the first affinity program for the American Mountain Guide Association, which is like the certification for folks for climbing. And so Brown Rose Climb was the first women's affinity space program. And then from there, they were able to branch out other affinity programs. And so we were, back in the day, just throwing things at the wall and seeing if they would stick, and a lot of them did. We did a lot of policy work, so we climbed the hill, we got into work with like the Access Fund. We recognized as climbers, like also, how do we connect with Indigenous communities, and what does that look like for education for us? And then also recognizing building out festivals. So we spent 3 years building out a climbing festival called Color the Crag, which was a space of bringing folks together. Inspiration by Mikhail Martin, who created Brothers of Climber, and Betty of Brown Rose Climb. And then I was able to hop in to become a programmer. And then I did behind the scenes logistics stuff to help out for the festival. We did it for 3 years. And like our last year, we ended with 400 folks from not only across the country, but across the world that came to this festival in HP 40 in Steele, Alabama. And that was the other thing too. It's just like, we want to not only share and build and work in our climbing communities, but we also want to showcase how climbing isn't just going to like Joe's Valley or Yosemite, but that there's climbing closer to home and there's climbing communities that are closer to home. And so that's a big thing on the East Coast too, because most folks wouldn't think of climbing, you're thinking Rocky Mountains of West, but now there's this beauty of folks recognizing the beauty of climbing on the East Coast. And then also, how do you bring climbing and understand the community's everyday life into it? And that was another big thing for BDC. Yes, we are all women of color, but we all navigate so much just in the daily life of what goes on in the administration to going on with our own communities. And we can't just turn that off. We can't just say that we don't do politic conversations, because that doesn't make any sense. And so being able to be that organization that we, that's just how it's always been for us, has been hard. I'm not gonna say it's been easy, because people will lash out, like even me called Brown Rose Climb at the time, but that was radical because Brown wasn't a name and we were already isolating another whole genre like of climbers, people in the outdoors, when really we're just creating a space for folks that want to come and partake and be seen and heard. And so yeah, so now being able to be in 9 locations across the country, we have over 37 volunteers who are able to gain their skills and knowledge of whether it's becoming a guide or just wanting to gain their skills in the climbing or mountaineering space. So being able to take courses for free, because we pay for them, to being able to teach their own communities, to build out their own programs, workshops, and things like that. And that's like our big goal, is like, we just want to be a resource. We want to be able to uplift folks who want to take this idea and branch it out into their own communities and expand more. We are not like the sole person or sole organization. We are an organization that has resources and realize we do have many resources because we have been able to connect. And so my thing is, now we have these resources, how do we give them out to other folks? How are other folks able to use them? So that could be being an athlete and like needing support. Last year was a lot because we did a big transition of becoming a nonprofit, and that's a whole process of its own. There's no handbook on that. I'm still learning my role as an ED now because there's no rule book of that. But this year as a staff, we had a staff training. Our theme is capacity, and really talking about how though we want to continue doing all these things for our community, we also have to think about capacity for ourselves and our organization. Though we're big in the sense of people know what we do, who we are, we're still a small organization, as in we don't get all the funding that we need, and that our staff is part-time staff and they also have other jobs. And so therefore their capacity is limited. It's a big note for this year, is just recognizing capacity. But we want to do all these dope things. We also have to be mindful that we might not be able to, but also working around how do we get our funding for an organization that's been around for a while. And unfortunately, as I've learned, women-led, women of color-led organizations are often the most underfunded organization in general across the country. Yeah. So that is a big thing. I mean, we've done a lot. We got to experience. We got to test out a lot of things that make sense. And what the overall beautiful thing is, recognizing Brown Girls Climb. Obviously, our IG is still going. It's just seeing how we are now in the third generation of climbers. And when I explain that to people, is that the first generation was just like the people before us who inspired me to continue climbing. Maybe their stories weren't being told, but then because we started Brown Rose Climb, you were able to connect with them, be able to tell their stories, have them get uplifted, have them be seen as, oh wow, they have first Black woman to climb El Capitan, Sophia Danningberg, who's the first Black woman to climb Everest. And so being able to have these prominent names who have done this before we even started be uplifted. And then the middle generation is like what I consider myself and like our national team that we had, our folks who are like in the outdoor space but still aren't seeing themselves but are trying to create that space. At the time, there weren't that many grants that were catered towards us. To now we're in this third generation where there's a lot more affinity organizations and or grants, and or there are a lot more Black and Brown Indigenous athletes on big teams. And so we're seeing this new growth of normalization of we are part of this. Also noting there's still a lot of room to grow, but coming from where I've been, I'm about to hit being in the outdoor industry 10 plus years, seeing that there has been changes. It's just as newer folks come in, they're like, nothing has changed yet. And yes, but also there are things that have changed a little bit. And so noting that, I think the beauty of seeing just there's more programs for folks to feel safe to go and learn because they can be in their own community versus taking a course in an unsafe environment. There are more grants that will cater to folks. There are more accessible spaces in the sense of you may not have to fly out in the middle of nowhere to take a wilderness first responder. You can actually take one going maybe an hour away from home. And so it's cool to see what's happening in this current and new generation. And then also see how folks just show up as their authentic self too, which has been something new in the new generation of outdoor leadership and connection and building of with Brown Girls Climbers. We don't have to do this facade. We don't have to code switch in spaces. Just show up as you. I remember my first time being in the outdoor industry, I felt, oh, in order to be accepted, I have to wear plaid. I have to wear khaki. I have to wear hiking boots. I have to look the part to be in the outdoors, where now I will show up sometimes wearing jeans and like a band tee or something and just be like, yes, I have all the knowledge, but this is me. This is how I want to show up. And so I think there's the beauty of this part of the generation of the outdoor climbing space too. It's like people are just showing up as how they are and like also taking up that space, but also calling in when it needs to be called in, calling out when those like situations arise, and like having folks as a collective rally and like really discuss to like progress. But yeah, that's a full perspective. I do love that I get to be a part of that and get to help build out things for folks to take on their own and build out their own communities and or projects or programs or whatever have to. And that's BGC's goal. It's like, we want to celebrate, we want to create space for mentorship, we also want to storytell about all the women and non-binary folks of color that are in the climbing and outdoor space, and then also as much as we can share resources.
Amazing. And you have accomplished so much in really what is such a short period of time. I appreciate that you're now like reflecting inward on capacity, because it's probably time, but just the incredible growth and the incredible response. And I have so much that I want to talk about, because I know like that intentionality and that accountability is why you've been so successful. So tell me about reciprocal recreation, because that is one of the like of how Brown Girls Climb approaches going out into the world.
Yeah. Though we are, a women of color organization, a big thing that we discussed too is understanding that we all have so many different stories and backgrounds. And so how do we understand, respect, and learn about each other's stories and backgrounds? And part of that is like understanding as we're navigating, going outside, we want to also understand the historical context of the indigenous communities in those spaces. How do we uplift those stories, understand and know that this is land that has been taken away and now we are out here climbing on it? How can we also be respectful and also educate others? It's also the same a little bit of Black history of entering into spaces, understanding whether it's hiking or climbing. Just filling in historical context helps bring a bigger light of, oh, wow, this makes sense of why maybe these community wasn't getting connected out to the outdoors, or maybe this is why this community had a weird taste towards climbers. And so how can we show up in a way that feels respectful and understanding? So a big thing is noting is like, we are all learning, but we also have to be respectful too. Taking that initiative within our own community, we can set that example of being respectful. So that could mean if someone in our own community said, hey, don't climb in this area because right now it's being used for ceremonial use, we can be like, great, that's good to know. How can we also help support on that education? And so we'll do some education lessons around this. And so within our own community, we're like, wow, I didn't even know about that. Thanks for sharing. Versus having it be like a tug of war, which oftentimes other communities, that is the thing of hierarchy, white supremacy of I'm going to still do this because it's what I want to do, versus being like, I hear that you want us to respect the space. We got you. We're going to take a moment of not climbing. And maybe go somewhere else. Or maybe, I guess our vacation is done and we'll just figure something else. Sounds easier said than done, but oftentimes there's a lot of pushback. And I think within our communities, we recognize the hierarchy of that. We also understand that white supremacy is tools that is often used against us. And so we try to figure out how can we come together to at least recognize that. Colonialism also takes a big note of it. And so so a big thing is just recognizing there's so many different layers of when you're bringing in many different marginalized communities together, but what can we do to at least help alleviate and understand where everyone is coming from? And sometimes that takes time. Sometimes there's pushback. Sometimes it's not as easy as it could be, but we want to make note that we try to be as mindful as we can and with that is educating not only ourselves, but educating the communities that we get to connect and serve with. And by doing so, it's really taking that time to understand the mindfulness of recreating in the outdoors. And yes, learning leave no trace is also important, but also how do you learn leave no trace in a way that feels more effective for the community versus just a list of rules? And so how do you do it in a more like mindful way? And a great example of like one of the rules is like not playing loud music, but also recognizing in some cultures playing music in that space might be a tradition. And so how do we navigate understanding that tradition? Or like picking flowers, some like communities, especially indigenous communities, that is a ceremonial thing of picking a flower. So how do we, though we have these all these rules around being in the outdoors, how do we actually navigate these rules of understanding of, oh, actually that makes, this rule doesn't make sense because they're picking flowers for like medical use or ceremonial use. Yeah, just teaching people build there's these all these things that are built out, but actually it like pushes other marginalized communities away. And so how do we build out an info of understanding? It's easy sometimes. Sometimes it's not easy. I will say that.
That's so important. There is nuance around leave no trace that doesn't get discussed very often. Mm-hmm. These prescriptive rules from white-led organizations that really don't take into account how other cultures interact with outdoor space. And that's such an important perspective. And thank you for talking about that. Another thing that you've been really intentional about is language. You use the language people of the global majority, and you use girls, and you've been very intentional about that. So talk to me about why that was important to you and what those mean to you.
Yeah. So with people of the global majority, PGM1 is also a really cool conference. And I think that's where I first learned the term of recognizing the expansion of what does BIPOC mean. And so for us, the term BIPOC had its moment of it made sense because it was often used for in the workplace of like when you're grouping people together, which in a sense BGM still is grouping people, but I'll expand. But with BIPOC, as we've seen later on, that term has been watered down because people aren't actually understanding that BIPOC does mean Black Indigenous people of color. And so whether it's organizations or brands or scholarships, when they utilize that word, oftentimes there's a lot of people in that identity not being served. You could have a space where it's a BIPOC night, but are there actually, how many Black and Indigenous folks are actually showing up into this space? And if not, then does that term actually make sense for you to use? And oftentimes it is another quick way for people to not even say Black or Indigenous, they just say BIPOC. And then when literally when you're actually talking about the Black community, no, you're talking specifically about the Black community, you need to say Black and not BIPOC, because that's not who we are, Black or African American. And that's like a whole other sector of using those terms as well. But we, for a while, I think we were using BIPOC in the beginning. And then we, during our 5 years of sitting down of language, of does that really actually make sense for who we connect and get to work with? And no, and in a sense, people global majority was a term that made more sense for us to use, because also understanding though, yeah, you can have Black and Indigenous folks in the community. You can also have those folks in all of the diasporas of those communities, in the folks that we work with globally. So many folks have different identities. And so being able to say, oh, I don't think I'm able to show up in this space because I am not just one versus the other. But being able, if you are part of the global majority, someone that is under the marginalized community space, it made more sense for us to use that when we're lumping people together. And again, I don't like lumping people together, but unfortunately in the way the world works, like when you're discussing community, and if you're working with more than one identity, it's a lot easier. And so if I need to say BIPOC, I will spell it out because I'd rather do that. Because also people, global majority is still in a way a new term, there's air quotes around that, and people don't recognize that. So therefore I will say people, global majority, and like put a caveat of this also connects with Black and Indigenous people, so folks grasp that understanding, but it's still a term that isn't vastly used around in the outdoor industry specifically. And I'm hoping that it will be when we have to do group size conversations versus using BIPOC as group size conversations, because I also think it's just it's a good debate too, because there's people within the community who actually like to use the term BIPOC. So there's that caveat, like some people live in the community, for them that makes sense. And so not saying like I'm speaking for all of Lud, I'm just speaking from my first perspective and like our organizational perspective as well. And then I'm thinking I this is actually such a great question when I think about Brown Girls Climb, the term of girls, because Betty paid the title Brown Girls Climb. We actually have gone back and forth with, do we want to change the name? Or we often use BGC as like a short term, but it's interesting. Yeah, if you see that, because we also in our kind of our extended mission, we talk about how though our focus is like women of color, we also work with folks who are also impacted in a wider range of the system. So that's also trans and non-binary folks. And so those folks, yeah, in a sense, don't fit under our name, but we also try to make space for those folks as well, because we also recognize there's not as many organizations or groups that are there to help support them in whatever they need to do to grow in climbing and outdoor space. Obviously, there's more affinity groups that are coming out that are focused within the LGBTQ community, but also noting at the time there were not many. And so we left that space open of like, we recognize like you also don't have that space, but we want you to be part of our space. And we still do. And folks will show up and ask questions of, oh yeah, I am non-binary. Am I able to come to the meetup? I'm like, no questions asked. If this is a space that feels safe for you, you're more than welcome to join us, and recognizing that the title is Brown Girls Climb, but we always welcome anyone who feels comfortable enough to join into that space as well.
I love that. And I love confronting the term BIPOC. When we started this 4 years ago, there was a lot of conversation about what is a word that we can use, fitting inside the confines of social media and trying to be like quick and snappy, but also to recognize that we're trying to build an affinity space where everyone's identity, distinct identity is recognized. And we used BIPOC. And the first post we ever did was what we mean when we say BIPOC. And now I do find when I'm speaking in spaces other than social media, I'm saying individuals from communities that fit under the broader BIPOC umbrella in order to foreclose on people collapsing different identities of individuals and communities into each other. There's really no perfect approach to this. And I really do appreciate your perspective.
It's an ongoing conversation. I feel like there's so many new awakenings happening within our own communities of, does this term actually make sense, of were we just using this because it was like given past for like white supremacy culture to be like, oh yes, this works, they will now accept the work that we're doing because we're using a word that feels palatable for them, versus does it actually feel good for me, does it feel good for what we're doing type of thing. And yeah, I feel like it's a continuing ongoing conversation, and we'll just start seeing more of a shift, which I think is good too, which gets me stoked, is like we're willing to have these conversations within community, because I think that's who you should be having these conversations with, of like learning and understanding of, oh yeah, we use it, but why don't you use it, and vice versa. I have no perfect answer because it's still one of those questions that will ever be changed, updated, and continue to be worked on for generations to come.
Yeah, no, I love it. And I love the conversation. More into language, talking about the climbing industry and language around the climbing industry, you in your capacity with Brown Girls Climb, with Outdoor Afro, in your outdoor education, you've confronted some of the language, the colonial language around climbing, about firsts, about conquest, about conquering mountains. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, that's another ongoing conversation where for a while there was a big shift in folks actually trying to make a change with it and then disappearing, which has been a trend. But recognizing not only just thinking of the idea of conquering first, because in reality, we weren't whoever, whatever climb, whatever mountain that you conquered first or put a first ascent on, more than likely you weren't the first person. It was probably an indigenous person that their whole entire family ancestry got erased because of colonialism and taking over land and natural park systems and all that fun jazz. And I think really putting that idea into the caveat of like when we build out like the first and what does that look like, also having that deeper conversation within ourselves, and it goes along with like names, because a big part of being the first person to do something is that now you get to name it, now you get to claim it as your own. And oftentimes when people build out climbs specifically and name it out their own, their names are always very sexist, homophobic, Islamophobic, ableist, and people let them stay. A big thing of the pushback of name changes about taking away history for the name, or what the most baseline of this person could have come up with any other name, but they decided to name this route the racist as a joke, or golden shower. These are names, real names of climbs. And we're at a point in time where, sure, at back in the day when the climbers was, it was cool to like be very like cruel with the words that you use. It's not anymore. There's so many more folks that are climbing outside. And I think also recognizing that is another way that creates climbing to become inaccessible, because who wants to go outside, climb on a climb, and then find out that the climb that they climbed was a horrific name and that doesn't leave a good noting. And then for a lot of the time, like if it's their first time and they're not used to being outside, that's all they're going to think about. Oh, are all climbing lanes this like horrible? Do people tend to name these like this? And or are they all this violent? It's obviously the case, it's not always, but if you're someone new and entering into a space, that's the first taste you're going to get. And then you're going to be like, I actually don't want to be part of this community if this is how people respect each other, is by naming things in a horrible way and or just erase names. Obviously, we're seeing the bringing back of Indigenous mountain names. And so like the erasure of names, like an example, like when I was saying like Mount Rainier's real name is Tahoma, or Mount Baker's real name is Coleman Cochon. And so taking the time to actually making sure we're understanding the names of the mountain ways, and also understanding, like, I don't know, I have a weird thing about the first, even within our own community. I think it's like there's a powerful thing with it. Well, wow, we actually did something accomplishing. And then also understanding there is that weird colonial piece to it of, oh, now we claim this land that's technically not ours, but we still did something really amazing for our community. And it puts us in a very like weird space. I guess that's like the only way that I can think about it. Yeah, I don't know. I think overall it's like one of those continuing conversations, like how are we not only educating ourselves but each other when we are getting into these bigger spaces, like remote spaces especially, and also getting into climbing and learning about how like route names start out, and like how if you are someone that wants to be a route developer and wants to create these climbs, like how can you do it in a way that makes sense, that's more ethical and a little bit more on the positive side for folks for the future who want to climb in that space.
I completely recognize that tension. As a Black biracial woman, I want to celebrate when women of color break a barrier and become first to do something. Then I also get frustrated why in the year of our Lord 2024 is it first today? It should have been first decades ago. And then it's also, that language of conquest doesn't sit right with me. It's an interesting tension that we work through. Yeah. Color the Crag. You talked a little bit about Color the Crag, which is an incredible festival. You've been involved with a few since, so with Blackout Fest, with working with Black Girl Boulder, most recently United and Yosemite. So first of all, tell me about United and Yosemite.
Yeah, United and Yosemite is a climbing festival that connects and brings all different marginalized identities and communities together to have the experience of climbing and understanding the environmental landscape of Yosemite, and specifically the Yosemite Valley. Yosemite Valley, Yosemite in general, is a beautiful space, but it's very inaccessible if you're someone that doesn't have a car, doesn't have like a park pass, because we know national parks are very expensive, maybe access to campgrounds, climbing gear, and all of that. It adds up. And so being able to create a little bit of accessibility and experience for folks to have a weekend of climbing and learning and somebody building community, but then also understanding really fully the environmental impact of that space, and also the historical understanding of the Indigenous communities that were there, that still live there and have such a deep rooted connection to the valley and that whole landscape itself. And so I think, again, multi-layers of why it's important to have these type of spaces, because yes, it's not just getting folks outside, it's also getting folks outside connected and learning and understanding, what makes our community appreciate even more why we get to go climb or bike. And so it was a beautiful festival. There's a different organizations from queer Crush Climbing, Latina Outdoors, Paraclip Climbers. I feel like I'm missing a few. Prepping in Color. And then also being able to work like the American Alpine Club helped out and being able to work with the Yosemite Conservancy. And so really building out a space for folks to just intertwine. So not only was it just folks with different abilities to folks with different identities coming together to just be. And so I think that was also important, showing up in the landscape of, wow, also other marginalized communities also navigate this in many different ways. And we had adaptive clinics to making sure folks felt comfortable just in community and space together, because though you're in nature, there's a lot of other elements. You have weather, you have fire burns going, you have bears, we have snakes, you have the starry night. So being in this space, it could be your first time ever camping outside. And I think doing so in a community helps make that experience so much more richer and wanting you to do it again versus going by, like sometimes going by yourself doesn't help people feel connected, but I think a lot of times people feel overwhelmed by doing so, and like also safety concerns. You feel comfortable in bigger numbers and people that you can relate to. And so, yeah, we had a bunch of clinics, like intro to trad, to art, painting, like water landscapes, to having an indigenous workshop where folks were understanding and learning about the environmental issues, but also under how do you navigate connecting to the land in a way that feels reciprocal and connectable and mindful. We had Eddie from the Everest team come and speak. We had the Farm to Crad come and make a beautiful dinner. So it's just like a beautiful just space to be like in the summer. And yeah, it was super fun. I enjoy doing logistics stuff and behind the scenes and like building out these spaces for others to enjoy. And so it was just magical to be a part of, to be honest. Yeah. And like a lot of things were picked from, obviously, from Color of the Crag, which Color of the Crag got a lot of its baseline works from the climate festival called Flash Foxy. It's showing an example of like, when we build out these spaces, we also want to utilize the resources of folks who have done it before and share the highs, the lows, the things to think about. So that way, at least you can build out a successful first year event. And obviously things go awry because nothing is ever perfect, but you know, as long as people enjoyed it, and then you can come back and figure out how do you make it better for the next year. So obviously there's another one happening this year, which is super exciting. And I can't wait to hang out with folks again.
With every one of these festivals, obviously it's been very clear about being in community, building community in space, but it's also been a really intentional approach to taking space and mm-hmm. taking up space. These spaces are coded as very white spaces. The sport mm-hmm. is coded as a very white sport. And the media that goes around it, the intentionality behind building it, the very intentional approach to building community in the space is like an attempt to recode that space almost.
Yeah. Yeah. We talk a lot about that. I feel like it can bring back into a lot of things of recognizing taking up space helps when you do it in numbers and as a collective. Oftentimes, though, when taking up space, you always get that pushback. So though we're in Yosemite Natural Park, there are thousands of other visitors in the space, 1,000 other visitors who are not welcoming the two others. And so when you're able to experience something like this, you can do it in a group, and you can also do it with people who have the language or maybe the experience to de-escalate situation. I think that's a big thing with festivals. Even within festivals, you can have your own taking up space and still feel out of space too. And so that's something we also should recognize. We always talk about, well, yes, climbing is a very white sport and can be very isolating, but also within our own communities, we can be very isolating and also cause own gatekeep. So how do we be mindful, like when we're creating these spaces, that we're not just creating them for the most popular folks within the community doing things, and but creating it for everyone who wants to be part of and everyone who wants to have a voice. And I think the idea of taking up space now goes with that, within like the outside scope of, yes, we get to show up in the space and be like, we're here, we're not going anywhere, we're going to show up as our authentic self and be who we are, but then also take that lens and look within us and be like, though we're taking up space, who is actually taking up the space? Is everyone being seen in the spaces that we're taking up? Does everyone get the voice to be able to stand up? Are we able to take in the accountability that we need to continue growing this, the environments that we want to be a part of? And sometimes those are hard lessons, hard conversations to have, because community work is, it's beautiful and powerful, but it's also really hard, because I think recognizing it's a lot to do with accountability within too, because if you want to work with everyone, you're going to learn, you're going to hurt someone at some point, and you're going to have to take that in and learn and then move forward. And oftentimes, I think it's harder for us to do that because we're already at a high tension point of trying to create space, try to dismantle white supremacy. And so when that happens within, we can get very defensive and combative against our own. And so recognizing how can we hold ourselves, but to also take up space. And so that can be, I think for me, it's like taking up space and also mean stepping back from space. And the thing of not so much talking about taking up space in a white environment, but taking up space within a community. It's, oh yes, you have all this knowledge and resources, but now it's time to step a little bit back or stand to the side to allow other folk come in. And so that's that idea of leaving the door open, always leaving the door open a few inches, so that way some other folks can actually open up the door, and also remind them, hey, don't forget to leave the door open, more can come through. So that way there's a chain of accountability and taking up space without it always just being maybe that one face that is doing it. And yeah, that's something I've been processing within the community wise. When people say taking up space, I started to think about it more so about within our own affinity groups and marginalized collectives that we build. Like, how are we making sure we're taking up space in a way that feels mindful? And then also, obviously, taking up space to combat white supremacy, but really looking within, there's a lot more levels of tools that we gotta like maybe dismantle within our own selves to build out even more beautiful spaces or enhance the spaces that we're already building out, type of thing. I hope that wasn't too rambly. I hope
not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. That is such an important lesson. And thank you for that perspective. We're running into overtime. I want to be mindful of your time. But before I let you go away, I want you to talk to me about the market, the Brown Girls Climb market, and the financial sovereignty and the values-based retail experience. How did this come to be? What was the impetus for this? Because I think it's so innovative.
Yeah, and it's so interesting that you said that, because now there are so many different outlets and more folks highlighting marginalized brands. And so that was like the whole thing of recognizing in the outdoor industry, we have our big brands, our semi-big brands, but not a lot of the brands we knew at the time were being highlighted from not only Black Indigenous communities, but adaptive communities, queer communities who are making gear within. And at the time, there wasn't really a space for a directory where folks could actually, I really want to focus on making sure my gear is all Black owned or Indigenous owned. But there isn't a resource to do so. And so that's where the BGC market came about, where, you know, it's a full directory of current, and it's not everyone because there's more brands that are being built out, but it's a space where folks can look up hard good gears that's made from like Black owned businesses to camping food to art to books, and having it in one space where it's easy to find. You also get to learn about the not only the history of that brand itself, but I think a key thing, especially coming in within the last few years, especially this year, folks want to know the ethics behind the brand. What are you actually doing within the community? You are a green brand, but what is your consideration of doing green work or environmental work like? So we have that listed of, this is what this company is doing with their work besides just selling gear. And then also noting too that the directory, no one pays for being on the website as a small brand. So the big thing is like making sure that all money, we don't make money from the directory. That money, all of it goes directly back to those said brands. And so that kind of gives that resource where some companies might say, oh yeah, we got to take a 15% cut or 20% cut because you're on our website or in our store, where we're like, nope, this is up to directory. Folks literally will link and go to you to buy their goods. If they're Brown Girls Climb member, they may get like a nice discount when they shop there, but all that money goes back towards them. And I think that was a big thing, is like making sure that we don't take any cuts from it. The only money that we would get is from bigger brands who have billions of dollars who would want to help invest and keep the website going. That's where that money was coming from. But yeah, BGC made nothing for the marketplace. And we just get to really highlight brands. And I also want to note too, it's a space where we share resources of not only gear, but also outfitters. Because that's also a big thing. People don't know, there's actually now two different Black outdoor stores, and like one of them is in New York City. That's like our newest one, called Outlandish. And so being able to have that information in a spot of, like, oh, cool, there's one in Massachusetts, there's one in Texas. So that's also a big thing of, like, how can we make sure we're, like, honing in a space for resources? Because, yes, IG is a great tool, but oftentimes algorithms don't align and get you to where you need to be or to see what you want. And websites are still just a good fundamental tool. You have everything right in front of you type of deal. And then we also just share, too, about adaptive friendly gear and plus size, extended size gear, because that's also a thing. There was a big movement. I think there's some brands that are still doing it, but really finding also people from those identities making gear also makes a big difference of folks wanting to purchase that stuff. But then noting that there's also, we have a resource for folks who want to do the more sustainable route, which is they are looking for used gear. They're looking to donate their gear. And so we have resources like that. And that way, all of this is like in one spot. So much so of directory versus, like, for us, for the community, anything else than us trying to make a profit off of the space. Right now, we're like re-updating and adding new folks onto the website. Like I said, capacity wise, we are super small, so it takes forever for us to update things, but we're excited this year to update. But yeah, noting that the BTC marketplace, we have a forum, so we like tell folks if they have a brand that they want added on the marketplace to send them the forum, so that way we can add them on there. But yeah, it's just a really great site for folks to like want to shop within our community. I highlighted this during Black Friday because with everything going on in the world, folks are just trying to find other ways of not supporting big brands, but still needing outdoor gear and wanting to shop small and within community. And so this is like one of the great highlight places to do, which is really cool.
It's a wonderful resource, and thank you for it. So we're sitting down, it's the end of February. It'll be March when this goes live. You're just coming off your break time. So what's next for BCG?
A lot is next. So we have a couple of events that are happening around. For March, we're just getting right back into rolling into hosting meetups. So we'll host our meetup calendar. We're getting stoked this year. We're going to be doing a lot more outdoor events across the country. We're going to be showing up at a lot more festivals, hosting workshops, which I'm really excited about. And so we're slowly just getting ourselves in our groove because March, like, accumulates spring. So that's when we're about to pop up and go with our flow. And yeah, we're really stoked on just like a couple of big projects that will be happening. We have some cool, big, like, national events that will be going on that will be shared out throughout the year. And yeah, just stoked for that. What else big things I can say? Not many things because I'm like waiting for the rollout moment. But yeah, March is going to be a nice, beautiful way to roll out International Women's History Month. And yeah, and just stay tuned for some cool outdoor stuff happening across the country this year.
Where are we staying tuned? Where do we find you? Where do we follow you?
Yeah, so you can follow us on IG at Broad Girls Climb. We do have a TikTok. It's slowly becoming active. We're going to start doing more educational programs on there. And same name, Broad Girls Climb on TikTok. But also, you can sign up for a newsletter. That's where we're going to be posting a lot of information, our blogs, and also just like schedule what's happening across the country. And then also, we have a Broad Girls Climb app for our members where it's like a separate space where it's not IG or Facebook, but where we share information. But it's also for where women color climbers and non-binary folks can come and connect together and find climbing partners. A lot of folks have been able to do, so that's another way to stay in touch. But three ways are IG, social media, the newsletter, and the Brown Girls Climb app.
Perfect. Brittany, this has been incredible, and I just absolutely love your energy. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, and looking forward to seeing all the dope things that you're going to be doing too.
And that is it for this episode. Thank you everyone for listening. Links on where to find Brittany and Brown Girls Climb and all the things we talked about are available on the show notes at BIPOCOutside.com. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. And if you did, don't hesitate to smash the like button. I hope you'll join us again for another episode of BIPOC Outside.